I'm Jerry Barney, and I head a little institute called the Institute for 21st Century Studies, and that organization is devoted to encouraging countries to take a serious, integrated look at where their development is taking them, and to make some serious plans to develop the kind of future that they'd like to have. I have brought some material on what we're doing, and I'm going to get that put into the reserve library, and if any of you'd like to look at it, it'll be available there. What I'm planning to do is to talk about this week some of the things that I think are going to be major determinants of the future of the planet. And basically there are two things. One is the prospects for development in some of the poorest parts of the world, and in a way also the development in the richest parts of the world, because those things are tied together and interrelated. The second major thing is our concept of security, and particularly the use of nuclear weapons in security, but in trying to achieve security, but not exclusively those two things. Then there'll be two sessions on what I call development or issues, and there'll be two sessions on the kind of security things, and the fifth session this week will be kind of bringing those two things, those two issues, all together in a kind of synthesis. In the second week, I'll be talking about what I think these issues mean for the church and for Christians individually. As I look ahead, I see some tremendous opportunities and some enormous dangers as well. And I think that the church has an opportunity to play a very constructive and very positive role. If that's going to happen, however, in my view at least, there's going to have to be some really major changes in the way in which the church operates. And at present, I'm not sure the degree to which the church is going to be flexible enough to accommodate those kinds of changes. So that's kind of an overview of what I want to do in the two-week period that I'll be here. Tonight I want to talk about some, the concept of development that has been along for a good many years in at least in industrialized countries. And the concept of justice and equity that underlies that concept. If you think about the terms developed and less developed or underdeveloped, you think that the United States right away is a developed industrialized country. You think that Western Europe is, and Japan. Taiwan is becoming that way. So in a sense you could think that these countries typify or are examples of an end process that all countries are going through, and that the goal of development is to become a country that looks like the United States or looks like Japan or looks like Western Europe in some way. And a part of the thinking about development and about equity and justice in the world too has centered on the plight of the poorest of the people in the world. And occasionally an argument gets raised or an issue raised that somehow the poorest of the people in the world are not getting a fair shake, that there's not justice when some people have so much and some people have so little. For many years, for many decades, really, the answer that was traditionally given to that question was to represent as a pie chart, or as a pie, the total gross national product, it's called, of the world, or gross domestic product of the individual nations. And say, well, yes, the industrialized countries of the world have a big piece. You take all those countries together, their total economic output and the income of the people is maybe half or more of the income of the world. Their population doesn't amount to anywhere near that amount. And some of the populous countries have relatively small fraction of the total income and total industrial output. So that would be a little tiny wedge. And the argument has always been that it didn't matter that one little piece was, or one piece was very small, even though there were lots of people, because if people worked, in the sense of the Protestant ethic, work ethic, if people would really work, if they would not be lazy, they could make their piece arbitrarily big. The pie could get bigger and bigger, and everybody could be rich. And there was no reason to really worry about that, about any question of distribution. But that was not a serious ethical question or a moral question. So those issues kind of get swept aside, and major bankers, you know, could go to sleep at night untroubled because of the idea that the economic pie of the world could be bigger and bigger, and even if you had only a relatively thin slice, that slice could get very big. So people were fairly comfortable with this idea. There were certain problems even then that were recognized. One had to do with patents. When Carol and I first went to China in 1981 and worked with the Chinese to get a serious study of the future of China underway, one of the things that our host, Mr. Lin, talked with us about was the inequity of the patent system. So we've had some bad luck. We've had the Cultural Revolution. We've had a number of years of really very slow development and inadequate education, and we haven't really developed inventions that we haven't kept up during this period. And now, because we haven't kept up, the nations of the world want to charge us exorbitant licensing fees in order to get access to patents and modern technology. And we think that's unreasonable. That a way in which nations could help us without undue sacrifice would simply allow us, to have access to patents. So the same thing with copyrights, that they couldn't have access except at very high cost to copyrights. So they simply decided not to become part of the international copyright and patent system, and simply to take whatever they wanted and whatever they needed and use it. And perhaps at some later date they would become a part of that. But there were penalties that went along with not being a part of the patent system. Another part of this difficulty is what are called trade barriers, that countries that are very poor, people are willing to work for very little, and they might be willing to weave cloth or make shoes or make steel, or whatever it is. And they find it unfair if we won't allow those products into our country. Our workers, of course, don't find it unfair at all. They want to protect their jobs, and that means if they allow low-cost goods into the country, then nobody wants to buy the high-cost goods that come from factories where our workers charge are paid very high wages relative to what people in other countries are paid. So those were recognized as being issues all the way along the way. But then, in the early 70s, a book was published, or got, the research got started. It was called The Limits to Growth Book. And this book raised an issue that is by no means resolved yet. It was an enormous controversy. The book itself was sponsored by an organization called the Club of Rome. And it's a little bit of a mysterious group. It essentially a non-organization. It's a group of approximately 100 people, mostly men, who have generally done very well in life, or are retired, or independently wealthy, and who were concerned about something that they called the predicament of mankind, or the world problematique. And that consists of a whole lot of things. It's the unemployment, it's the poverty in the face of plenty in other areas. It's the expanding deserts, it's the change of the atmosphere, it's the nuclear threats. It's all these things together that they referred to as the world problematique. They saw that all countries were involved in these things. They saw that there were many different factors, all of which were interrelated and not really amenable to solution one thing at a time. And so they commissioned a group to work on an integrated study of what was happening in the world. And that study happened to be done at MIT by Jay Forrester and Dennis Meadows and some others there, Donella Meadows, in 1970. And I, by accident, happened to be on a postdoctoral fellowship there at the time, and was working with that group even before it got started. So I was there and saw it all take place, but was not directly involved in conducting the research. They decided to build a computer model of the world, and that sounds pretty complicated and so forth, but in fact it's really not as complicated as it might sound. This particular computer model is, well, it's got several different major variables to it. One is population. And the population, of course, goes up and down according to the balance between birth rates and death rates. And births add people to the population, deaths take them away. And it's a relatively simple thing to work with. Resources was another variable in it. And they lumped all resources together into a single variable, which is a pretty gross approximation, but for a model as simple as this one, it was the best they could do. They had a pollution variable. They had capital variables dealing with agriculture, with industry, and with service. And capital is buildings, for example. It's machinery. That's what economists mean by that term, capital. And they had a variable for arable land. You take land that's not under cultivation and clear it and improve it, and that makes it into arable land. You can erode it. You can let salt build up in the soil, and it ceases to be arable land. But when they put all this together, they would make projections with the model. They start out with a set of conditions that would describe the world at a given time, so say 1900, and put in data that would cause the model to trace out history up to about 1970, and then let the model run on into the future and trace out the prospects for the future. Now, in the book, there's descriptions of these various model runs that they made, and also a description of the model itself, and there's also a big, thick technical report on the work. But I'm going to show you just a couple of the model runs. The blue figure here is what they referred to as their standard run. That was when they simply adjusted the initial parameters to reflect what seemed to be going on in 1970 and assumed that that would continue on into the future. Let's see if there's enough cord here to get up a little closer. Resources were beginning to be depleted. That was one factor. And as they made the run, starting in 1990, going to 2000 and on out to 2000 or 2100. That's a pretty long time period to be making projections, but that's what they were doing. So resources declined. Population continued to grow and reached quite a high figure, and then couldn't be sustained and declined again. Pollution increased some, particularly in the early part of the 21st century, but declined again. The thing, food production per capita increased pretty well until around 2000 or a little later, and so did industrial output, but thereafter began to decline. The decline in this case was precipitated by the consumption of resources. For example, the exhaustion of oil would be a good example of what might have happened. Now, they made a whole lot of different tests of this model. They said, for example, suppose we were wrong about the amount of resources available. And so they did a case in which there were twice as many resources as they had assumed. When that happened, there was a pollution explosion that took place about 2050 and created a rapid increase of the death rate and brought the population down again. They tried an unlimited resource case in which there was a conservation measures were introduced. And that also led to a pollution explosion. There were tests of pollution controls. That led to a land crisis where there was simply insufficient agricultural land to take care of the needs of the people. Then they tried increasing agricultural productivity, and that allowed industrial expansion and population growth to continue until there was another pollution crisis. So there were a wide range of things that they tested with their with the model, and finally hit upon a collection of policies that would make a difference, would actually level out the situation and avoid any massive decline in the population as a result of a rapid increase in the death rate. This is the picture that shows how they finally got things balanced out. To do that, it required resource conservation, it required pollution control technology, it required serious attention to population growth, and agricultural improvements in agricultural technology. And the one that surprised people a lot was that it required some constraints on the expansion of industry. And that unchecked, unlimited expansion of industry was a problem. It produced greater standard of wealth, more per capita income, but there was also much more waste that went along with it. The end result of that was an argument, if you will, or a suggestion that there were limits to the total wealth of the world that was possible without creating some kind of a problem, a pollution problem, a reduction or an exhaustion of the amount of land that was available for agriculture. Something of this sort would show up one way or another. And that, the idea that the economic pie for the world could not become incrementally large, was a revolutionary idea. And it's revolutionary because it introduces the idea that we have to pay some attention to the equity question, the distribution question. It's no longer all right to say that it doesn't matter if one thin slice of the pie goes to a very large population on the earth, when a very big piece of the pie goes to a very small part of the population. And in that way, the Limits to Growth book raised an ethical issue that has not begun to be resolved as yet. It is an issue that it's a major political issue. President Reagan ran in part in his election campaign on the idea that there are no limits to growth. And in fact, in several of his State of the Union messages, he emphasized that he had argued during his campaign that there are no limits to growth and that he had been right. I personally think that it's a little premature to be able to say whether that is correct or not. I should say that the book does have some critics. One of the major criticisms of the book is that it does not include prices, and that if you include prices, all of the difficulties simply go away. The invisible hand of Adam Smith will put all things right. I have to say that in looking at the model pretty carefully, I believe that they have built in to their equations many, if not all, of the effects of increasing prices. I really don't think that that's one of the things that, that I would point to as one of the reasons, or as a reason to dismiss the work. I think that if you are going to dismiss it, it's necessary to go to the work of developing a counter-argument that says that I've taken all these things into account and show how prices or something else would correct the matter. There have been a couple of attempts to do that. One was done by Vasily Leontiev, who won the Nobel Prize for econometrics. He did an analysis for the United Nations, under contract with the United Nations. It struck me when I read the report as being a very political document, because the United Nations wanted to build a case that if you did everything that they wanted to have done, that the world would be all right. So all of the cases in which all the UN assumptions were built into the model were presented first. And many of the things that the UN was requesting were not very realistic at all. But that's what was presented first, and that's what the press release was all based on. There was some analysis by Leontiev that got presented in a small appendix in the report that I thought was a much more realistic assessment of the situation. And that showed a situation that looks very much like the work that is presented in the Limits of Growth book. There have been several other analyses since then, too. Some at Case Western Reserve, some in Europe, some in Japan. But I'd say that overall, the global analysis that has been done since 1970 has raised a fundamental question about whether or not it is possible for everyone in the world to have the standard of living that we have in the United States. And if that is in fact the case,
then there's some really serious questions that have to be raised about the distribution of wealth. And it's a matter in which I think the church should be playing a much more active and important role. Now, I have about at the end of the things that I want to say tonight. I was asked to talk only a half an hour, and then to open it up for questions and discussion. I'll just conclude by saying that next time I'm going to talk about the global study that was done by the United States government. When Limits to Growth came out, many U.S. government agencies reviewed the work, and every one of them denounced it as being unsound and a lot of hooey and not to be paid any attention to. Several years later, it turned out that there was a request for a study, something like the global or the Limits to Growth study, that was signed by President Carter, and I ended up having the responsibility for directing that study. It was called the Global 2000 Report to the President. I have one copy here. Next time, I want to talk with you about the experience of directing a serious study of the future of the world from inside the U.S. government. The kind of political pressures that you encounter, the kinds of data and information that's available, and some of the conclusions that we arrived at in the course of that work. And that will be the end of what we talk about on development, and then in the succeeding two sessions we'll go on to talk about the ideas of security and the costs associated with trying to maintain our current concept of security. But I'd like to stop here at this point and see what questions you have.
I was wondering, you were saying that the United Nations had some proposals of things that should be done. Do you remember what types of things they were proposing?
Well, the proposals were embodied in some strategy documents that were called the First Development Decade and the Second Development Decade and things of this sort. And the Development Decade documents were framed around such recommendations as trade barriers should be eliminated, or the trade barriers for the industrialized countries should be scaled way down, and the poorest countries of the world should be allowed to put up their own trade barriers, or the industrialized countries should pledge themselves to pay 50 cents a pound for coffee, no matter what happens. They were things that were pretty idealistic and not likely to be achieved.
Were they all to do with commerce and economics, or were they to do with natural resources and that type of
thing? Well, they were basically having to do with commerce in natural resources. Food prices, prices of copper, Zambia, for example, has been hurt very badly because of the decision of the telephone companies to go into fiber optics rather than continue to use copper. So the copper price went way down for a time. It's come back some now, but the poorest countries of the world can make their living, their hard currency income, primarily on the basis of trading raw material. They don't manufacture things very much. And so that's what the UN was talking about. There was virtually nothing, a little bit, but almost nothing having to do with population in the Development Decade recommendation.
Or nothing to do with pollution?
Nothing on pollution. Absolutely nothing on pollution. Yes,
sir. I'm trying to kind of evaluate this computer simulation in some sort of context. I have a friend who did some work, I guess there's a program if you're a macroeconomist, you can get a grant to run run this program, which is in Washington, and test some particular theory out, which is going to be an experiment for another kind of scientist. And the way he described it, he was pretty negative about it and thought it was fairly worthless.
Which model?
Well, I don't know the name of it, actually, but he compared it to the weather model that ANCAR uses without any success, as far as I can tell. Essentially, we can't model weather yet. This seems to be, this may be a problem with a large complexity of variables. And he described the situation in economics as one where there are sort of believers and non-believers. That is, that some people think that the predictive power of these models is useful and applicable to future policy, let's say, and others who think that they're not yet sophisticated to do any sort of predictive. And I guess that's the sense of one of the criticisms of this book, which I would guess would be more primitive than what we have now. I gather that you take the results of this model seriously. And I'm just wondering whether there are two camps who view these kinds of models as useful, and maybe none of them are sophisticated enough yet to the other camp to say, well, we just can't model this stuff yet.
Well, what I take seriously out of this is not that the population in the year 2020 is going to be whatever this number is. I haven't even got a scale on there, plus or minus 2%. What I find the model is useful for is a medium for discussion. It's a way of taking a group of people who have trouble disagreeing on which way the stream runs out here, and getting to sit down and say, what do you think are the characteristics that will determine whether this is a desirable place to be living or this planet in a few more years or another century? And you can generally get people to say, well, I think we ought to have enough food. And I think we ought to be able to breathe the air and drink the water without getting sick. And a few things of that sort. And you can begin getting some consensus on what are the important factors. And you can also get people to talk about how these things are interrelated. And get the discussion focused down on some answerable questions. When people get to arguing, it's not a really very productive situation unless you can get the argument focused on something on which there's some hope of resolving it. And in my experience, people argue or fail to resolve an argument for three reasons. One is they simply haven't got the facts. And when you get a model in front of people, you can focus on what facts you ought to have and you don't have to get them. Another thing is that they argue about how the facts are interrelated. And if you've got the model there, you can test some of the things that you can put in alternative interrelationships and say, now, does that make sense? You actually can go out and do some experiments too and get some idea about how things are interrelated. And finally, they don't agree sometimes simply because they have different values. They value outcomes differently. And in that way, the model, I think, is quite useful. It's also a help because it begins to get the model that's in people's head out where people can see it. Now, everybody's got a model of how the world works. But it's pretty hard to understand what that model is in everybody's head. And nobody's got a complete model of it, but they're really quite useful in that regard. Let's get this one and then I'll get yours.
I'm looking at, you know, what alternatives may have been considered when you look at these trends, one being reduced industrial production. I assume that trying to make the nation, the capital nation, to be more like India, for example, where there's a fairly high standard of living but lesser intense industrial production, or that sort of ambience of an industry in the 21st century. So that being one alternative. I'm wondering about other alternatives, one of which is regarding space travel and obtaining resources from off the Earth and exporting population possibly exporting pollution to Venus or something of this sort. I mean, we're thinking about 200 years here. So that's one alternative I would wonder about, if that kind of creative and perhaps science fiction, but also possibly realistic thinking might be done. The other one is about undersea resources and population and cultivation. Are those kinds of things being addressed, as well as just looking at what we've got and feeling like it's clearly a shrinking pie, you know, oh, woe is me, the sky is falling?
I'd say yes, those are considered.
Can you let me know any further people who are involved in that, or what their thoughts have been? Is that being pursued?
Well, what I can do is refer you to a place where you could read in more detail. You know, the question you're answering or asking just opens up an enormous range of issues. You know, which undersea minerals, and you know, how serious are you about exporting people from the planet, and do you want to consider the energy costs of doing that, or don't you, and the pollution costs of doing it, or don't you? There's a lot of work that has been done on every one of those issues, and some of it at the Office of Technology Assessment, some of it in the Misarevich-Pestel work, some of it at the Food and Agriculture Organization. So a lot of different places where parts of that have been done. In the second volume of the Global 2000 report, there is a review of five of the major pieces of work that have been done investigating a wide range of things of that sort. And our organization also has published a fairly thick review of an additional six major studies of that sort. But there, yes, people are thinking about those. And there's not complete uniformity as to what the conclusion is. Yes?
The right-hand graph up there shows the resources decreasing. What happens out at 2300 and 2500? Does that then begin to cause these other curves to fall off? It seems to me like you have to have some effect from the decrease of resources.
Well, I think you do, but to know how serious that is, you need to get you need to have a more sophisticated model than this one, because all resources are lumped into a single variable in this model. And you know, there's a funny business about resources in terms of the name. We refer to aluminum, for example, as a non-renewable resource. And what we mean by that is that there's a certain stock of it in various grades of ore that we can get out of the ground. And depending on the price, some of that is economically viable to get out and use, and some of it isn't. But in some abstract sense, and at a given price, you could use it all up, in theory. Now, in fact, however, as you get nearer the end of the high-grade ore, prices do tend to go up, and you also start recycling. And some of the old dumps are now a place where you can gather some pretty impressive collections of interesting materials. And I think it's time for even the tailings out here. Now, we've heard that there's so much gold left in those tailings that at the current price of gold, it may make sense to mine those tailings. So, in a way, the mineral resources have possibilities. You don't destroy them. I mean, they're still there. The entropy has been increased enormously. They're scattered all over the place. Now, basically, what an economy is take minerals out of the ground or resources out of the ground, mix them all up in products and spew them all over in waste dumps and other places. But there's the possibility of going and getting those resources and reusing them for what are called non-renewable resources. The ones that are really precious, however, are what we refer to as renewable resources, because once you destroy the species from which those resources come, or constitute those resources, they're gone. and you can't do that. Passenger pigeons are the classic example. They made good pigeon pie, and they had the fatal flaw when you shot at them, all those who survived got back in a flock together again, and they made a terrific target. And finally, the last one was shot, and they were gone. Now, that's a really non-renewable resource. But you know, in terms of this, I just have to say there's a lot of possibilities that would have to be explored in much more depth than what's there.
Petroleum, I would think, would be a non-renewable.
Petroleum is a non-renewable resource, but there are lots of other energy possibilities that we can look at beyond petroleum.
Are you thinking then that the resource curve might flatten out in a sense?
Well, I'm thinking that if this were done with copper and lead and aluminum and petroleum and anthracite coal and you know, many other different kinds of curves up here, some of them are going to be the kind of curve that has a shape like this, basically, where you start out beginning to use the resource, you increase the rate of use quite rapidly, and reach some kind of a peak, and the thing falls off again. And that others would come in along the way and replace some of those resources. Some might come up and kind of level out and continue to be used for a long period of time. There'd be substitution that would take place. It's a pretty complicated thing to try to figure out. There are replacements of steel for aluminum and copper for aluminum. There's a lot of things that can be done. So it's not as simple as that by any means.
Can I ask one other question? Did your model show a figure for the peak of the population there in terms of
this one did,
billions
yes.
of people?
Yeah, I think that the peak was, if I remember right, around 10, 12 billion, something like that.
Compared to 5 billion now.
Yeah, well, I think it's unavoidable that we're going to get at least to 10 or 12. We may go quite a bit beyond that. China had hoped to keep its population to 1 billion. They're really trying. But it's likely to get to 1.25 or maybe 1.3 before they stop. And India is not close to being able to match that, and the Africans are just nowhere near bringing their population growth, or just even slowing it. Some of it is, there's still cases there where women are having 6, 8, 10 children. So some places in the world, population growth is still very, very rapid. Yes?
I have a two-part question, and I'll ask them both and then ask you to respond. First of all, when you look at the at the book, and I'm familiar with the book and actually have used it as a part of the course at times, in the 70s when it came out, and it always surprised me that there was such a reaction to it, because what that book is saying about the human species is no different from what ecologists have been saying about other species. And the models that have been done there are no different than the models that have been done by ecologists for native species for many years, and showing that any species has limits to growth in other species, not necessarily including industrial output, but certainly with the other curves. And you have these interdependencies. And I guess I've never figured out why this book has had such a strong reaction. And maybe you can react to that. Then secondly, just if you could comment in general about where you feel we are now, first of all as a society, and second of all as a government, although maybe you want to talk about that tomorrow, in terms of, it seems like people were becoming aware of these limits during what we call the environmental movement in the late 60s and early 70s, and that increased sensitivity when I look at it in terms of human nature, produced a real fear and almost a reactionary movement, which I think led Reagan to be elected, that he did, as you say, preach against the idea of limits to growth in any sort, in any sense. And that people, when they get scared about losing their physical comfort, will react in a way of kind of grabbing it into themselves. It's kind of basic human nature. And I'm wondering how you see our society, if that's the way you see it, or where you see our society leading right now. There's so much less sensitivity about population growth now than there was 10 years ago. And it just astounds me that kids going to college now really don't even have the idea that limiting their family's growth is a moral problem or a moral dilemma, and that they don't even think about this. And it's not being raised that much in a lot of college courses or in general among, you know, among people. It doesn't seem to be a part of our morality the way it was 10 or 15 years ago. Do you see this as kind of a reactionary or fear movement, or how do you see this, both in the government and in the society at large?
Well, let me take your first question first, and part of the second question I'll deal with tomorrow, Wednesday, when I talk about the experience of doing a study in the government. But when this book came out, there was a symposium held at the Smithsonian Institution in which a number of very prominent people were invited to come and speak. And one of the people who came was a Wall Street banker. I don't even remember the man's name, but very prominent figure from Wall Street. And he was asked to speak about the possibility of what a world would be like if industrial output leveled off and wasn't growing. And he got up and said, "I simply can't imagine such a situation," and sat down. It was beyond his comprehension to think about how a bank could even exist in a situation like this. Now, John Stuart Mill, a very famous economist, talked about steady state economy in some of his books and pointed out that they're likely to be very dynamic, a lot of change, a lot of innovation, a lot of excitement in such an economy. But they'd be very different. And I think part of the reason that book stirred such a reaction, well, I can think of two reasons. One is that it touched a really sensitive nerve, that all of a sudden people began to worry that that their idea about becoming richer and richer and richer might not be achievable, and that was very threatening. Another is that the study team made a mistake. They made two mistakes. One, there was a mistake in the computer program, and after it had been out for a while, it was discovered, and there was a correction published. It didn't change any of the conclusions, but that mistake got trumpeted around for quite a while as being a reason to disbelieve it. Another is that they made a strategic mistake in not having their technical report ready. It was almost 3 years after Limits to Growth was published before their book, Dynamics of Growth in a Finite World, was published. And without that to kind of back up their arguments, they were in a pretty vulnerable position. And so those are two things. But for the government, I think basically I want to hold that until the next talk, because there's a lot to say on that, more than I can handle quickly tonight.
Okay. What would you say about the societal awareness as a whole?
Well, I'd say there that I think you're right. It has slipped. But I do think that in spite of that, there have been some positive things happen. And we have made a lot of progress over the years in reducing air pollution. We've done a lot on water pollution. I'm not sure we've had as much success in solid waste. There have been some really positive things that have happened. The Nature Conservancy has done a wonderful job in getting some protection for endangered species. And there are some good things to point to. What really does seem to be missing, and something that I dearly wish the church would take an interest in, is looking at this overall collection of things to see how all the pieces fit together and what kind of a goal we want to have for not just this nation, but for the planet that we're all together on. That was a pretty exciting thing that was going on in the 70s, and to the degree that it's still going on, it goes on in just a few isolated places, and our institute is one of them, but there are a few others, but it's been very hard for the people that did that kind of work. The funding all dried up, it's been hard for many of them to hang on and continuing to do their work. Up here, let's take yours first.
Hey, I assume that they factored in natural disasters such as drought, famine,
no.
Earthquake. They
no,
didn't.
Those are all canceled out.
Okay. Would that be a realistic thing to factor in there? Or how about unnatural disasters such as nuclear?
That's not in there at all.
That's not factored.
No.
Is that something that needs to be considered before?
Well, you can put them in. A way that you can do that is to make assumptions about what the impact of a nuclear war would be and assume that you're going to have one here. At this time, well, let's not do it then. That's too close to me. Let's go in here and see what would happen afterward. There is a really interesting model. One of the, I'll show you a little book here that we have published. I take on some modest tasks. I've got a book that I've done called Managing a Nation. The subtitle, the software source book. And I have been collecting for about 8 years now microcomputer software that you can use to run a country. I now have a library of about 400 pieces of microcomputer software that you can use to run a country. And some of it is really interesting stuff. An accounting package for the Minister of Finance that allows the finance minister to keep track of all foreign debt for his country. I guess that would have saved Mexico about $10 billion. And you can get it for about, all installed with training, for about $10,000. But one I wanted to tell you about is a model of the recovery of the United States after a small nuclear war. And that's quite a fascinating model. And it was originally sponsored by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. They are the people who have responsibility for stockpiling resources and planning the recovery of the United States after war. And their position in their testimony to Congress was always been that it would be a relatively simple matter to put the U.S. back on track after a nuclear war. Well, this model didn't show that at all, and so they cut off funding for it. But a student at MIT did a PhD dissertation and kind of expanded and finished that model up. But there are ways, you know, the way this ties into your question is just to say that there are ways in which you can model even such things as complicated as the impact of a nuclear war. And there are some very interesting models of that sort that have been prepared. But this doesn't have any of that in it. Yes, sir, your question.
Just a two-parter again. Would like you to comment on the book Megatrends, and then secondly, given what you'd said earlier, as industrialized countries move their industry into third world countries, as that appears to be happening, is that somewhat bringing this to truth that when that happens, we sometimes see a reduced lifestyle in the industrialized countries? Is it, in a sense, is that reaching some sense of equilibrium where the industrialized countries are seeing a reduced lifestyle? Or are those third world countries really seeing an increased lifestyle with that movement of industry?
Okay, Megatrends is written by John Nesbitt, whom I've known for many years. It's using a methodology that has been developed and used at the CIA for a number of years. And it basically is counting column inches of newsprint. John hires a whole lot of high school kids at minimum wage and has them go through a lot of newspapers and clip out articles having to do with various things, and you don't read them, but you take a ruler to them and figure out how many column inches is being devoted to writing about them. And out of that, he concludes some things are very much on the public mind and are going to be important considerations in the future. His methodology certainly does have a way of measuring in a quantitative way the amount of public attention that's been given to a certain issue. The public attention is not always riveted on exactly the most important thing. And so I think it's a methodology that's got some merits, but it's not the only thing I'd want to look at. Now, your second question was on?
Just industries moving.
Oh, yes, right. Well, there are some real benefits that have occurred in some countries as a result of that. In Mexico, there's a whole zone across the northern part of Mexico where U.S. industries are allowed to go in there with the blessing of the Mexican government and create jobs, and then able to export things back into the United States without tariff. And Mexicans work at what for U.S. standards would be very low wages, but they get jobs, and they get a bit of training too, and there's some involvement of Mexican industrial leaders in the management of those plants. So there have been some benefits there. There are other cases in which the export is, I think, far less beneficial. There was, for a time, and I think there still continues to be, a desire to export dangerous, hazardous, and highly polluting activities. I've been working in Taiwan a fair amount over the last year and a half. And I'm frightened to eat anything in Taiwan, frankly. There is such a massive amount of heavy polluting industry in Taiwan, that and there's no pollution control at all. We'll call this the end of the session.